All right, people, we're going to give you what you want. Today's episode is all about nutrition for SIBO. Subtitle, crafting your perfect SIBO diet. Whoa.
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 That'd be a crazy book.
That would actually be a pretty stellar book. But here's the thing. It wouldn't be that good of a book because, mic drop, 30 seconds in, there's like basically no research on this topic.
Yeah.
So any book on this topic would be purely speculative in nature. Yeah.
Hypothetical.
Well, actually, that's kind of a jerk thing to say in the beginning of the episode. I don't want to say speculative because I do think that clinical experience counts for something, right? Like your experience as a clinician, seeing many, many cases respond over time, or like talking with your colleagues, I do think that that is like a certain level of evidence. But when we get down to it, you know, oftentimes people in our space and the people we work with, like, we want to be evidence-based, right? Well, this is an area where this is very much not evidence-based. This is, again, kind of like the group spitballing and figuring it out on the fly.
I feel like the problem is it'd be fine to say, you know, we're still learning, but I do feel like the attitude in the SIBO space is that this is very science-based and
very matter of fact.
If you don't do it this way, like, you're going to feed the SIBO and you're going to cause more problems. And it,
oh yeah,
and it's at the expense of someone's nutrition. So it's so wild, and it's not really presented as a symptom management tool. It's presented more as like a therapeutic intervention, if it makes sense. Like, you're going to actually be helping.
Well, yeah, you're treating the SIBO, right?
Right, you're treating the SIBO with the diet versus, okay, it's one thing to manage symptoms with something like the low FODMAP diet or different variations of a SIBO diet, but you're not, the idea that you're treating something is totally, again, hypothetical. Again, it's one thing to have symptom reduction, which I think has some value if you went on a diet that might limit FODMAPs or something like that. There is value in that. But I think the problem is the fear-mongering nature in the SIBO space around diets and the misinterpretation of what the diet is doing keeps people stuck and actually prevents proper nutrition. And that's where it shoots people in the foot, unfortunately, in the SIBO space doing some of these diets. But yeah, it's a weird, SIBO diets is a weird can of worms, and I'm glad we're diving into it.
And we're kind of revisiting it in a way. Like, if you think about it, we did an episode at the tail end of season one. So it would have been episode like 97, 98, somewhere in there. And we did I think we titled it SIBO Diet Down Low. And we talked about the pros and cons and research and uses of these different diets. So for those of you who might maybe are new kids on the block, commonly the diets that are used to quote unquote treat the SIBO would be things like the low FODMAP diet, the low FODMAP SCD hybrid diet that was popularized by Allison Seebecker. Mm-hmm. We've got the Cedars-Sinai low fermentation diet, and we've got the biphasic diet. And now, you know, even since we really recorded that episode a couple of years ago, now I would add a fifth into the mix, which is the carnivore diet. Mm. A lot of people are using the carnivore diet to try to treat SIBO. And there was one paper that attempted to examine that we're going to talk about today. But all of this basically is operating under the premise in the SIBO space of, oh, you're not going to feed the bacteria what they like, and therefore you're going to starve the SIBO, and therefore you're going to treat the SIBO. And that, again, there's zero evidence that we could do that. Versus, again, if you look at the research from like Monash University, who coined the term FODMAP and researches and develops the low FODMAP diet, they are extremely clear that low FODMAP is a symptom management tool. And they're actually very clear that low FODMAP has been repeatedly shown to deeper states of dysbiosis. So it's like, okay, you could use the Band-Aid or the crutch for a short period of time.
Right.
But the key is to broaden your diet as much as humanly possible so that you can stay nutritionally replete and healthy. And again, like, to use your analogy out the gate, you can't be the person who's shooting yourself in the foot and then wondering why you're walking with a limp.
Yeah. I love it.
Right? Like, and that's kind of what happens in the SIBO world. People come to us and they're like, I've tried everything. I don't know why I'm not getting better. I'm stuck. I've done all the GI maps. I've seen all the best doctors. I'm so confused. And then they come to us and we're like, well, you're malnourished for one, because right. you're eating 12 foods. So let's start with that. But, you know, by that point, people have dug themselves into a pretty deep hole. And it can be challenging to dig yourself out of that hole and get back on top.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's really interesting too, because you bring up Monash, and I think they do a really good job with educating providers. I think they do a decent job educating actual patients too, if you explore some of the resources. But it's so interesting because in practice, I feel like people are not really educating. Like there's a lot of providers that I don't think educate themselves enough. They just kind of skim it and they say, okay, this will be good for SIBO because we heard that you could starve the SIBO. Mm-hmm. And again, the weird thing is a lot of providers are so adamant that like, if you feed the SIBO, you're not going to get better. I've had providers say that to my patients and it's like so disordered to put in someone's head that, okay, this doesn't necessarily help me. Some people might not help get benefit symptom wise too. We could talk about that. But like, let's say you're not feeling good on low FODMAP. And so like your instincts are telling you to drift away. But then a provider says, hey, if you feed the SIBO, you're never going to get better. It's like, okay, this is just some core fear that's now triggered inside you. And what are you going to do? You're probably going to stay on the diet for longer than maybe what your intuition was initially telling you. And again, I think that that's the problem. It's like providers aren't well educated in the reintroduction process. I think they're...
They don't even know why they're using the diet in the first place. That's the foundational thing. Is like,
right.
They don't understand why they're even using this tool. They're just using it willy-nilly and without training. But I think I interrupted your train
of
thought.
And I want to say too, like, that's super dangerous. Again, to me, people view dietary interventions as not being that dangerous, like low risk. But if you start becoming malnourished because you've been on some of these diets long term, it is dangerous. And I think it's something to be really aware of. Like, these diets have risk. And again, some people can get the majority of the benefit by doing it properly with the proper guidance. But I think one thing that's really important to understand is that most people are misusing and abusing some of the dietary interventions, and it becomes dangerous. And like you said, it prevents progress. But again, if you're malnourished, it's going to affect every aspect of your health. And it just gets really tricky to climb out of that hole. It totally can be done, but I don't see many providers course correcting where they're like, oh, this person's, or assessing nutrition as a whole. But yeah, I just want people to understand, like, there is a lot of risks to doing some of these diets, and there can be benefits, and you want the benefits to outweigh the risks. And usually in a scenario where someone's well-educated and guiding you, you understand that the diet is a symptom management tool. And then again, like, there's a reintroduction phase. I think like all of those three pieces should be present, and more than likely, if the diet's going to be helpful, you'll reap the benefits without the risks, or with very little risk.
It's that balance point, right? Because I think everything we do is going to have some element of risk involved with it. But again, I think patients and practitioners have this mindset of, oh, nutrition is totally safe and holistic and always awesome. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that, again, they're really digging people a deeper hole and they're creating more problems and disordered eating and malnourishment than they realize. And similarly, like I've said this before about herbs, oftentimes there's this dialogue of drugs are bad. You shouldn't do drugs, but herbs and supplements are always wonderful and safe and puppy dogs and rainbows all the time. And it's like, oh no, I've seen real bad reactions from supplements and herbs when they're inappropriately used.
Yeah.
Right. So even something like an herb or a vitamin, like a B vitamin, I've seen really wacky stuff from a B vitamin supplement before.
Yeah.
And you have to, you and your provider have to be savvy enough to like weigh the benefit and risk for you as an individual, instead of just them saying, this is my SIBO protocol. I got it off of my functional medicine practitioner forum, or I heard it at a seminar once, or I heard one Allison Seebecker lecture, and boom, I'm going to use it on every single person with SIBO, even though they're all totally different.
Right.
And honestly, this kind of dovetails into a recent episode about the functional medicine space.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of the functional medicine episode that we did, where it's like, A, this is a group of people who unfortunately love protocols. They have their leaky gut protocol, their SIBO protocol, their candida protocol. And heaven forbid you don't fit into that protocol where you're a little bit different than the other candida patients, then that's on you, man. But also when we were talking about, you know, the idea of starving the SIBO and how providers will tell you point blank, if you don't starve the SIBO, it will come back and you'll never get better. Like using fear to gain compliance much. And that's something I talked about in the functional episode. Like a lot of my colleagues, unfortunately, use fear, whether it's intentional or unintentional, they use fear to get you to comply and they get you to do their protocols and stick around and ultimately spend money with their clinic. And it's just, it's real icky to use fear that way, especially when there's literally no evidence supporting that claim.
Well, and the wild thing about it is we see the opposite happening, right? Like the longer someone stays on these diets, usually the more it negatively affects their health and the more that they can reintroduce foods and build variety in their diet, the better they feel. So it is just so interesting that the whole, I would say the majority of the functional space is very into these diets. And I think a lot of people know that there should be a limit, but I also think that sometimes it comes down to just not being coached out of it either. Like they put someone on a diet and they just like kind of assume that they're adding stuff back in at some point and then they aren't. Or again, like there's just no continued conversation. So it's like, oh, here, you're doing low FODMAP. Great. And then there's no other follow-up, which I think happens a lot too. That happens a lot in the conventional GI space where like a GI doc hands you a handout and is like, hey, like follow this.
The one
like, I guess forever. Like, I don't know. Like, again, it's just they hand you a handout and send you on your way and there's no additional guidance on like what to do or how to introduce. And I think a lot of people get lost in the sauce with that too.
Well, I do agree. I think that happens in the conventional space, especially if there isn't, like, it's one thing if a GI doctor hands you a pamphlet about low FODMAP and then helps you get booked with a dietitian.
Right.
But it's another thing if they just give you the one pager and they're like, good luck, see you never. Right. And then, yeah, like, how are you supposed to know that you're supposed to reintroduce? But I see it happen in the functional space too. And I think that it's largely the followers of Allison Seebecker, because last I knew, and I kind of intentionally don't follow her stuff anymore because it enrages me, honestly. But last I knew, she was still of the mindset of you need to stay on low FODMAP or a SIBO diet for the rest of your life to prevent recurrence because SIBO's just going to relapse. That's just how it is. That means your treatment sucked. But, you know, like, oh, it's just a condition that relapses a lot. So you need this Band-Aid. And last I knew, she was a proponent of keeping people on this restrictive diet forever and ever and ever. So, like, I can't handle seeing her stuff anymore. To his credit, I have my issues with Dr. Pimentel, aka Pimentel. I'm never going to quickly, somebody said that in a conference once. They referred to him as Pimentel, and I've never forgotten it. It was the best moment of my life. Like,
now you say it so often that sometimes I automatically go to Pimentel instead of Pimentel. That's like, it's like,
well,
I can't but, remember his real name anymore. It's all blended in my brain now.
I have a few instances of that in my personal life as well with different things I say. But to his credit, he's a little bit more clear that it's a Band-Aid, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel like he has a more reasonable approach on diet. I feel like a long time ago I heard him talk where he was basically saying, you know, people with SIBO need to be going out to eat sometimes and like, you know, they need to have some flexibility, which I really appreciated. So again, like he was saying, you could modify stuff like if you're at a restaurant, but we still want to make sure someone has something to eat if they're like out and about. And it could still be a little bit challenging at different times. But I like that he sort of, you know, took a little bit of the pressure off the dietary side of things, because
Well, and his diet that he recommends is not as strict as the other ones.
Right.
Like when we talked about, I think we both agreed that it was the least restrictive of the so-called SIBO diets out there, the Cedar-Sinai low fermentation diet. And yeah, I think, you know, he does say in that handout that's been on the internet for like a decade at this point, but in that original handout about the low fermentation diet, he does make a point of saying that you're trying to starve the bacteria. But he also does kind of keep it real. And he says, you know, you can modify things and it's not like a total black or white strict sort of thing. And there's some stuff in that handout that is a little bit less strict and like disordered eating-ish,
right?
Which I do appreciate. But you know, I think that the name of the game still is to get off of these SIBO diets if you are on one. And if you're not on one yet, don't start. That's a little bit simplified, but let's just keep it simple for the sake of this episode. If you're not on one of these diets, do not start one at this point. Follow the other stuff we're going to talk about later in the episode. And if you are on one, well, the goal needs to be to get you off of it ASAP.
Yeah, well, I think it's not, the way I would view it is it shouldn't be the initial intervention. So that's the thing that drives me nuts, is it's like, it's just this assumed kind of initial intervention of like, oh, you have to do this out, right out the gate at the very beginning. It's like number one, one of the number one interventions. And again, I think there's a time and place for something like low FODMAP. There's a time and place for some of these diets, but most people definitely don't need to be on them. They're much better off working on feeding themselves properly. So how to nourish yourself properly versus worrying and putting all your energy into starving the SIBO, which again, there's no evidence that you actually can do that. And again, to the contrary, which we'll talk about, there's evidence that you could make dysbiosis much worse going on these diets and make the SIBO situation and the SIBO symptoms that you have much worse.
Yeah. And again, dig the hole.
Right.
You're and so digging deeper.
From my standpoint, it's like, even if there is a possibility, again, like I said, there's no evidence to support this at all, but theoretically, even if you could starve the SIBO, it's still, to me, way more important to make sure you're feeding yourself, because it affects the gut microbiome, motility, digestive capacity, immune function. It affects the whole environment in the gut, which is going to shape what microbes grow and what microbes don't. You'll feel way better. Again, like you'll have a healthier relationship with food. Focusing on nourishing yourself should be the first intervention for SIBO, not eliminating all these foods. Because again, a lot of people feel much better if they can optimize their nutrition, and it's a balanced approach and helps their health overall versus restricting, which could make things worse in the long run. It's a very short-term lens to view like your treatment plan through. If you're focusing a lot on the SIBO diets, it'll give you maybe some short-term relief at the beginning, which again has a time and place. But again, I think a lot of people could still get a lot of benefit even in the short term focusing on nutrition just as a whole. But again, we don't catch people usually at that point where we're like, you just got diagnosed with SIBO or IBS or whatever it is. We don't catch people quite at that point typically. And I wish we did, to say, hey, like first and foremost, just start with like nutrition 101. Like we talk about, how are you getting enough protein? Are you getting enough calories? Are you getting enough carbs and fiber and micronutrients? Like all these core things, there's still some challenge there and like different habits you need to work in, but it's definitely not as challenging as like remove a million things from your diet and like healthy stuff that's now bad. And the mental energy that's being sucked from you when you do some of these diets is so problematic too, where it consumes, it's more all consuming. You can make dietary habits that are very nourishing to your body that might take some energy to build some habits, but isn't going to be all consuming.
Well, and there's a, and we've talked about this in FODMAP episodes before, but with Monash in their training, they make a point of having kind of like the standard low FODMAP elimination, where you cut out a good majority of the foods or you drastically reduce them and only eat low FODMAP servings. But then they have a modified version where it's like, oh, if the person has a history of disordered eating, or they're like, you know, traveling all the time and they really can't pull off doing this strict diet because they're not cooking at home very often, or if it's a child, or if there are circumstances where you really don't think they're going to be able to implement the full low FODMAP diet, there's a modified version, like a watered down version, where, you know, maybe you just have them cut out the highest of the high FODMAP foods. So like wheat, onion, garlic, beans, and you leave it there. Or if there's a FODMAP that they seem like they overconsume, you know, the person who has two slices of avocado toast every single day of their life, like maybe you just start with removing avocado and see how that goes. Hmm. And you're kind of meeting the person where they're at, so to speak, which is nice. But again, I don't see this in the functional world. It's like all of these foods are evil and bad, and they're going to feed the SIBO. And if you eat them, you're a horrible person who clearly doesn't want to get better. What the hell are you doing? And it's just, again, it's like black and white, good and bad. But there was a study to kind of gear up to my point here. There was a study, and I don't have the citation pulled up, so I can't tell you the title or the PubMed ID. But I think we might have talked about this before, but it was basically comparing low FODMAP versus what they called standard dietary advice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they had one group do the standard low FODMAP elimination for the 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it was with reintro. And then they had another group who was given dietary counseling to reduce common IBS triggers. So things like caffeine, excess fat, so-called gassy foods. So like beans and cabbage, I think, were the two foods that they listed by name. But then they also made a point of saying that the emphasis was on how to eat rather than what to eat. So they talked about like eating at a regular time interval, slowing down and chewing your food, really like just giving yourself the time and space to process your meal. And that was the emphasis of the so-called like standard dietary advice. And the two groups had equal outcomes. They both saw a reduction in symptoms, but it's like, which one would you rather do? Would you rather do low FODMAP that is freaking complicated and you don't get to eat any of your favorite foods and you have no social life and you can't go out to restaurants and you feel trapped by this diet and it's really freaking hard? Oh, and you're going to be more malnourished because you're cutting out so many foods. Mm. Or would you rather just slow down a little bit, eat at a regular time, chew your food, and maybe reduce or cut out like a couple of more obvious triggers like caffeine and super high fat foods and like beans?
Right.
Like the latter sounds much more desirable and doable to me, at least. But, you know, there are several of these studies. There was another one looking at low FODMAP versus doing yoga twice a week, and they had equal outcomes. And yep. I even posed this to my FODMAP Freedom students early on in the modules. I'm like, which would you rather do? Would you rather do a restricted hellish diet, or would you rather do yoga for twice a week, man?
Yeah.
You're telling me you don't have 50 minutes times two to get your butt to the yoga studio?
Well, it's wild because, again, you would, if you're going to do this diet that takes a lot of time, is a lot of effort, takes a lot of mental energy.
A lot of risk.
A lot of risk. You better see like a huge margin compared to, you know, just general kind of how to eat or when to eat, how to eat type advice, how to balance things a little bit better. You better see like a huge margin over that group. And you don't. You see, well, you know.
Can I interrupt you though?
Yeah.
I will counter something you said earlier and what you're kind of saying now. I do think, and you said this, there's a time and a place for these interventions. Right. They're not intrinsically bad. We're not intrinsically anti-FODMAP. Like, again, both of us have taken the Monash training. We know how to use it appropriately. But one example, and I say this knowing the risk, because every single human being on planet Earth has I'm special syndrome. And we all tend to get in our head and think that we have the most special, worstest case ever. And clearly, she's talking about this one case that happened one time that was like the worst. And clearly, that is also me, right? So just check that in your brain, people, because I know we all have that affliction. I'm not immune to it. But keep in mind, I have been working with SIBO for 10 years. And I have seen this like one true case where I would say that this really happened. I still remember I met with this woman, sweetest lady, and she was such a mess. Just what I'm telling you, I have sections on my notes for the first appointment with people where I'm kind of checking off SIBO root causes to sort of think about the likelihood of SIBO. She had all the check marks. I mean, like, she was on PPI for years and years at a high dose. She had multiple really, really severe food poisonings, hypothyroid, autoimmune disease, had had abdominal surgery, she'd taken opioids, all the things. And she had Crohn's and celiac disease and maybe rheumatoid, I forget now, but she had several autoimmune diseases. And the nature of her autoimmunity was extremely severe. Like, if I get cross-contaminated with gluten, I'm resilient enough at this point that I don't oftentimes notice it. If I get blatantly glutenated, what'll happen is I will have the runs for about 10 minutes, and my gut will purge everything out of my system, and then I feel totally fine 10 minutes later, and I'm good. So that's kind of my status as a celiac these days, because I've done a lot of healing. If she gets cross-contaminated with even the tiniest amount of gluten, she had to go to the ER, literally.
Right.
And she got to a point where she really honestly could not safely eat at a restaurant unless it was 100% dedicated gluten-free, because she would wind up at the ER. So she comes in to see me, and again, like, all of the history and the symptoms and everything is matching for probably a hell of a case of SIBO, to a point where she was one. I was still ordering SIBO breath tests at the time because I didn't know how badly they sucked. And I even told her, we can't even test you for this because I think that provoking it with a sugar substrate is going to probably be a really, really, really bad idea for you. And I don't want to run the risk of sending you to the ER because I'm trying to test you for SIBO. Like, I think this would be ill-advised. So we're just going to treat empirically with no testing. And for her, and how massively inflamed she was and how severe her symptoms were and her history that was just screaming SIBO, I actually did send her home from the first appointment. And I said, we're going to try to Band-Aid this real quick and get you some degree of symptomatic relief. And I taught her about the low FODMAP diet. Mm-hmm. And I explicitly told her numerous times that this is a Band-Aid. It's not a forever thing, but I do think it's going to offer some relief and get you kind of on your feet a bit more and functional. And honestly, like, we'll cut the things out now and we'll worry about reintroducing later. But I repeated several times that the goal is very much to reintroduce. And it was like night and day difference. She, you know, her inflammation went way down. Her, you know, her joint pain and her joint swelling was way down. She lost some weight, but she was overweight. That was part of her story. So, like, I think it was actually a healthy amount for her in the time frame that it was. And she felt way better. And we had started the prokinetics. Now, unfortunately, she kind of dropped off the radar and I didn't get a chance to follow up with her a lot going forward. But there is a time and a place with these really, really, really severe cases where I think that getting that quick Band-Aid in place can be useful. But again, this has happened one time over 10 years of working with SIBO. This is very much not the norm in my practice. And I agree. I think that people jump straight into these restrictive diets as a first line treatment. And that's 99.99999% of the time, that is inappropriate and unnecessary and potentially dangerous. Because you're digging that hole. You're making yourself more dysbiosis and more malnourishment and a crispier and crispier vagus nerve. And then you wonder why you get stuck going this route.
Right.
Anyway, long rambling story.
No, it's totally true. I think that that's inherently the problem, is that it is the first line intervention and not like, oh, have you tried some of these other things first? Or again, like if you are similar to the severe case that you listed, like maybe it does make sense to do it for, you know, 2 to 4 weeks and see if it helps, and then kind of decide how you're going to move forward from there. But yeah,
this is like the 15th time I've interrupted you this episode. It's the IBS Freedom Podcast, people. It happens. But I was just going to say that keep in mind, too, I was not only doing the diet with her.
Right.
I also sent her home with the prokinetic speed dating tester kids, and I talked about motility. I talked about, you know, the MMC and trying to restore that. So that's the thing, too, is I wasn't just doing the diet, and I wasn't even telling her we're going to start placebo. I just said, this is going to get you some, I think this will get you some quick symptomatic relief, help you function better and feel better. And then our real work is going to be on promoting motility and that gut brain kind of work.
Right.
So that's the other thing too, is I find that sometimes the diet is the only or like the main thing, or if there's anything else being used in conjunction, it's antimicrobials or antibiotics. Right. So again, it's like two sides of the same coin. You're killing and starving. And that's the only angle that's taken. And that's part of the problem too, is that even if you do use one of these symptomatic band-aids, that shouldn't be the only thing you use. It's kind of analogous to if you have diarrhea, yes, you could use Imodium, but that shouldn't be the only thing you do for all of your days.
Right. Well, again, I think like IBS, SIBO are, you know, rooted typically in issues in the gut-brain axis. So like if you're doing nothing to address the breakdowns in motility and digestion and immune function and nutrition in general, which again, I think is going to be really important for how the gut functions and how the nervous system functions. If you're doing nothing in these areas, it's not the approaches with the herbals and the diet are not root causal. And that's just kind of the bummer. And I think a lot of people view SIBO as the root cause, and it's just not. So,
well, they're told that it's a root cause.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, yeah, and again, like, SIBO is no more of a root cause than candida or leaky gut. Mm-hmm. You don't just get leaky gut spontaneously for the hell of it, and you don't just get SIBO spontaneously for the heck of it. Something happened that, and actually, here, this is a good point to maybe start transitioning us over to some of the research in this area, because, you know, I keep an eye on PubMed on this topic, and I have seen to date 3 articles that actually try to examine this idea of a dietary approach for SIBO. And I revisited all of them yesterday, and I know Amy read some of them too. So, you know, one of them, for example, from May of 2022, titled "Diet and Intestinal Bacterial Overgrowth, Is There Evidence?" And one of the things that they actually said at one point is, in the physiological state, there are mechanisms to prevent excessive colonization of bacteria in the small intestine, such as an acidic stomach pH, pancreatic enzymes, and intestinal immune system, small intestinal peristalsis, aka motility, and ileocecal valve, and the intestinal barrier itself. However, when changes in any of these mechanisms occur, SIBO can develop. I would throw in bile, and I would throw in a couple more things into that list. But yeah, it's when there are insufficiencies or breakdowns in these protective mechanisms, that's when SIBO happens. But then so little of the treatment is focused on these root causal things, right? Like, I mean, dietitian in the house, like, how many nutrients do you need to just make stomach acid alone? You know, if you think about it, how many nutrients do you need to make stomach acid, right? Like, you need what? Zinc, magnesium. You obviously need hydrogen and chloride. You need, you know, we talked about this with Thomas way back when in season 1, in like episode 30 something, but you need good blood flow to go to the parietal cells so that they have the ATP to push the hydrogen ions against that gradient. So that means that you need any of the nutrients for blood flow, like iron and copper and B12 and folate, B6. So you could kind of make the argument that you need a lot of different nutrients, even just for one of these things to happen. let alone pancreatic enzymes and the intestinal barrier and the immune system. So again, it's very frustrating that there's no attention paid really to making sure the person has adequate levels of vitamins and minerals. And hell, if we're talking about ATP, you just need calories.
Right.
Right. Like if somebody's dropping weight and they're not taking in enough energy, they're never going to have enough energy to push those hydrogen ions into their stomach and make freaking stomach acid.
Yeah, 100%. I think that a lot of issues resolve when nutrition's optimized. And I think, again, like, I will acknowledge that there's definitely some challenges. There's usually more challenges. There's usually more challenges. I don't know why I could not say that for a second. There's more challenges the longer someone's been restrictive, typically. But I acknowledge, too, that if you are having discomfort and things like that, sometimes it just naturally causes a little bit of undereating or changing how you're changing your meal patterns and things like that. And then it can be this cycle of like, ooh, I'm just slightly undereating every day. And it can be a little challenging to optimize nutrition if you already are symptomatic. And doing some of these things, like you mentioned, like a prokinetic or, you know, some digestive aids while you work on nutrition as a whole can definitely be helpful. And again, that to me would be a better first line intervention than jumping on FODMAP or something like that, or jumping on a dietary intervention. I'd much rather someone try to kind of support these underlying mechanisms while you're doing other things that should help you support those naturally without help. Again, getting nutrition is one of those things. But if getting nutrition is challenging, you know, having some things that support some of the protective mechanisms that might be struggling a little bit at the moment can be beneficial so that you can actually get the nutrition that you need, get the nutrients you need for some of these things to function. And again, I will say, just with writing my book, it is insane the nutrient needs, the gut-related nutrient needs that we all have, like, and how many processes micronutrients and overall nutrition, how many processes are affected by micronutrients and overall nutrition. Like, it is insane. You talk about immune function, motility, digestive capacity, like you mentioned, everything's going to be governed by nutrition in some way. And that doesn't mean
the microbiota itself, too.
Right.
Microbiota. Like the microbes need a lot of these same nutrients that we need. They need mm-hmm. thiamine. They need riboflavin. They need, you know, whatever.
Right. I think it's funny because the SIBO space typically will be like, well, they'll steal your nutrients. And it's like, no, I mean, you're still going to get the nutrition and they will use some of the nutrients you eat. But it's a symbiotic relationship where you, again, you know what I mean? Like, I think that the SIBO space would probably argue and be like, but they could steal your nutrients. And that's how there's just misconceptions around that is basically what I'm saying.
Hold on, though. Let's pause here for a quick second. This is a valid point. So, and this has a really easy answer. The problem is how we're choosing to define SIBO.
Right.
And how we are horrendously, chronically overdiagnosing this condition. Mm-hmm. So, if you got diagnosed with SIBO back in like the 1980s or 1990s, and you had like short bowel syndrome, right? And then you got diagnosed with SIBO. Oh my God, that was a huge freaking deal. And these were people who were genuinely presenting with signs of malabsorption, low B12 levels, you know, macrocytic, B12 deficiency anemia. Like mm-hmm. they were really, truly malnourished because the SIBO was appearing to steal their nutrients.
Right.
But that doesn't happen with the people that we work with. That version of SIBO, if you had that version of SIBO, you would know it because you would also be diagnosed with short bowel syndrome probably.
Right.
Or you would have had like a bowel resection or something really major. But, you know, for the run of the mill, and God, I'm going to get hate comments for that statement. For the average IBS or SIBO sufferer, where SIBO might be on the table, just know that what you are calling SIBO does not match what we used to call SIBO. And the two things should have different names, in my opinion. So that's the disconnect. But the thing is, in research, we call it the same thing. And there's not a lot of attention being paid to the fact that we're lowering the bar diagnostically and we're right. using crappier and crappier tests, lactulose breath test, I'm looking at you. So it's like people get diagnosed with this label and they think that it's the same as that other label and they think that they have malnutrition. And their providers, well-intentioned though they may be, incorrectly tell people that they have malabsorption because of SIBO. And they don't realize that the bacterial counts between the two worlds are completely different, like not even on the same planet.
Right.
Right. So yeah, like SIBO can cause malabsorption, but probably not for you listening to this episode right now.
Right. There needs to be more nuance. And again, like you said, we probably need to really figure out how we're defining SIBO. Because again, it's a much wimpier, unfortunate, I hate using that word, but like it's a much wimpier threshold to get a diagnosis compared to historic,
low. Right. The bar is on the floor.
Compared to historic SIBO levels. And again, the lower threshold and lower bar isn't associated with the SIBO syndrome or the malabsorption that historically you would see with the SIBO thresholds when they were much higher. I agree. I think that there's no nuance in the conversation, which causes a lot of problems. And for, you know, like you said, 99% of our cases, you're probably not going to be, bugs shouldn't be stealing your nutrients. And I would not try to get that image in your head or that idea in your head too much. Because even it kind of cracks me up too, because even if that was the case, you still need to nourish yourself. Now, again, you might have to take different approaches, but like, I think the idea too, where like your own nutrition just takes a total backseat because there's so much intense focus on how to starve things and that sort of stuff is very disordered, even if it was true.
Well, to maybe phrase it another way, I agree. To phrase it another way, if you genuinely had a clinical condition that made you more prone to nutritional deficiencies, wouldn't the response to that be to make sure that you're like extra nourished, not less nourished?
Yes, 100%.
So like maybe you do chronometer tracking and instead of trying to hit 100% daily value on your B12, if you really honest to God think that you have malabsorption, maybe the answer is that you need to be hitting like 500% on chronometer every day for your B12. You know, but again, it's really freaking hard to do that when you do a restricted diet and you're cutting out things left and right because, again, somebody told you it's a boogeyman or it's bad or it's going to starve the SIBO. So it's very counterintuitive. And, you know, one of the things that was in this paper that I cited earlier, they did mention that the dietary treatment for SIBO should theoretically be focused on dealing with the SIBO and also dealing with nutritional deficiencies. But then they dropped the ball and they didn't mention the latter at all again in the rest of the paper. So I was like, oh, you were so close. You were right there.
Yeah.
Bless your heart. But you know, if you think about it, how many nutrients do you need just to make stomach acid alone, right? Like, I mean, zinc, magnesium, obviously hydrogen, obviously chloride, so salt, you need salt. But then we talked about this briefly in the episode we did with Thomas in season one. You need blood flow to get ATP for the parietal cells so that they can push the hydrogen into the stomach. So then you need things like iron and B12 and copper and B6 and folate and basically any nutrients you need for good, healthy blood flow and oxygen delivery. And again, we're only talking about nutrients that you need to make stomach acid, let alone heal your gut lining, make pancreatic enzymes, make bile, keep your immune system happy and healthy and functional. Like there's so much nutrition that you need to run these apparatuses that prevent SIBO. And then we're going on, not we, but you know, we, you guys are by and large going on these restrictive malnourishing diets. And again, you're wondering why you're stuck. And it's like, you probably had some nutritional deficiencies going into the SIBO situation.
Yeah.
And now the hole is way deeper and you have way more and way more severe nutritional deficiencies. And people get themselves into a pickle real quick. But I want to share a couple more quotes from that study that I cited earlier. And you know, they were so close. They did say earlier in the study, let me see if I can find the quote. They said here, the principle for treating SIBO involves treating the underlying disease or condition to eradicate the bacterial overgrowth and possible associated nutritional deficiencies. And this was pretty early on in the study, and I got really excited, and I thought, oh, they're going to talk about something that matters. And then they just dropped the ball. And they did not discuss, you know, like these quote-unquote SIBO diets being high risk for thiamine deficiency or, you know, restricted diets and not getting enough folate or B12. They didn't talk about any of that. No mention of a single vitamin or mineral for the rest of the paper. But then in the conclusion of the paper, they said, therefore, it's important to be careful when prescribing restrictive diets, since the most severe cases of SIBO can cause malabsorption syndrome, which can lead to nutritional risk, and a healthy diet rich in vegetables and whole foods seems to be the best option to obtain a balanced microbiota. So again, like they touch on this just a tiny bit, this idea of being careful of nutrient restriction in this crowd, but then again, there's no real advice or context or fleshing out of that idea in the rest of the paper. We're going to come back to the microbiota bit in a minute because that's super duper important too. But here's something that we could pause on just for a quick moment. Two more quotes. I'm sorry. I feel like this is the boring part of the podcast now because I'm just reciting quotes. But I highlighted them in my Word document, damn it. So we're gonna talk about it. So first of all, I love this one. This is kind of a dig. We're spilling the tea. Ready?
Oh man.
So this paper said, other types of diets, such as a carbohydrate elimination diet and the specific SIBO diet, put in quotes, which are commonly disseminated on websites, do not have scientific evidence to support such a prescription. I was like, ooh.
Whoa.
You're calling people out with that one. You're not naming names, but you're naming names.
Right, exactly.
So that delighted me. But this, I want to pause on this. This one I thought was interesting. So last bit from this particular paper, they said, a recent meta-analysis in which most articles included were from Western countries, with only one Asian study, assessed the association between SIBO and obesity. It was observed that the risk of SIBO was 3 times higher among individuals with obesity than among individuals without obesity when evaluating only the Western population. The results highlight the importance of diets, the importance that diet plays in the intestinal microbiota, since a Western diet rich in sugars and fat has been shown to reduce beneficial intestinal microorganisms in obese individuals. Like, okay, well, again, dietitian in the house, what kind of diet would you recommend if you wanted to help somebody lose weight? Like, if you had an obese client come in and they said, I want to lose weight, what kind of stuff would you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think from my standpoint, you would increase protein typically. Mm-hmm. You would eat a wide range of fruits, vegetables to get some fiber. Make sure they're eating, nutrient-dense carb sources. Like, again, it's a lot of the similar advice.
It's the same stuff. Get vitamins and minerals. Make sure you're not deficient. Right. Again, probably pump the fiber and the protein in particular, because then, they're going to get satiety and feel satiated and full for longer. Right. But it's the same kind of crap. And importantly, you would want them to run a slight caloric deficit, right?
Right.
Not crazy, like not what we see with the IBS and SIBO crowd.
I would say like you wouldn't want to go over 500 calorie deficit. Usually, like I would say around 300 is like a lower stress deficit that's not going to set you back or affect hormones quite as much.
And spike your cortisol, screw with your thyroid, and then your motility goes out the window. Yeah, it's a subtle calorie deficit while increasing some of these nutrients that are important for building healthy tissues, increasing satiety, keeping the microbiota happy and healthy. You know, it's not rocket science kind of stuff, but maybe for some people, their perfect SIBO diet is a weight loss diet, essentially. And it doesn't have to be super specific to SIBO. Or maybe you layer on eliminating onion, garlic, and wheat and beans for a short period of time. If it is causing symptomatic issues and like bloating, you know, maybe you layer on that slightly modified version of low FODMAP just to like band-aid some of the symptoms so that you can work on the other things. But that I thought that was an interesting angle, and the other papers that I read didn't really address that specifically, but I have seen those papers that indicate that SIBO is more common in obese individuals as opposed to lean individuals.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it is really interesting. I think, again, in terms of figuring out what you should eat, first and foremost, being nourished is number one. So if no one's assessing that at all, make sure that either you try to assess it or find someone that can. It doesn't have to be perfect, but I think if you're checking enough nutritional boxes, you're going to be in a much better place than someone that's not. And then again, I'm excited too to talk about the microbiome side of the equation.
SIBO's inherently a microbial thing. There's a strong microbial element to SIBO, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, in terms of a lot of the popular diets, I know we've talked about this before, they do tend to lower good microbes, which again is not what you want when the typical IBS population already has low levels of bifido and some of these healthier microbes. So if you're lowering those things further, that's not what you'd want from a microbiome standpoint. And again, we know too that it seems like dysbiosis is more associated with symptoms. So again, if you're doing things that are creating dysbiosis by lowering good microbes, which usually leave room for some of the more problematic microbes that are associated with SIBO and IBS, like that's a big, big problem. You're basically like driving a root causal issue unknowingly. Again, like that's not the intention, but it's not discussed, which is problematic.
Well, and again, to go back to the imagery that we've been painting this whole episode, it's this idea that you start off in a shallow hole and you realize that you're in a hole and you want to treat the hole. But then with every treatment that you're doing, oftentimes, typically, every single treatment is scooping out another shovel of dirt and actually making the hole deeper. And again, like we get people when they're so deep in the hole that we could barely right. reach a hand to them.
Barely even see them down there.
Yeah. Versus when you start out, maybe the dysbiosis and the nutritional deficiencies and the fiber deficiency, like maybe those things were much more easy to work around when you first started. But yeah, that actually brings me to the other paper that we visited for this episode. So this one is titled Efficacy of an Irritable Bowel Syndrome Diet in the Treatment of Small Intestinal Bacterial Overgrowth, a Narrative Review. And this was August of 2022. And right out the gate, I love that they put this in here. They said, first of all, based on current available literature, the potential efficacy of the IBS diet in SIBO is largely hypothetical. Again, we have no evidence for this. And they said, a low FODMAP diet proposed for IBS may promote a negative shift in the gut microbiota and deepen the existing state of dysbiosis in SIBO patients.
Yeah.
Again, digging the hole. And this reminds me of that paper that you and I really love. What was it, 2019? Mm-hmm. The one, it was like, small intestinal dysbiosis underlies symptoms of...
like functional GI symptoms, yeah, or something like that.
Something to that effect. I mean, I could look it up if we want to actually pull the reference for people, but they had a couple of different parts of that study, but one of them, they took people who were completely asymptomatic and they were eating a high fiber diet, which, by the way, they defined high fiber as basically hitting the daily value.
Well, no, I think it was like 21 grams. I looked at that study more and
You're right. Yeah, it wasn't even hitting the daily value.
Right. I looked at it for my book and I was like, oh, 21 grams. That's still below the, it's 25 grams for women and 38 grams is recommended for men. I'm like, and 21 grams is the high fiber group? Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So it was just kind of funny.
Yeah, you're right now that you mentioned that. But because I remember they gave the number per like 1100 calories of the diet. They gave it that way instead of a number. And yeah. Anyway, so they took the high fiber group. And they, again, these people were completely asymptomatic. They were fine. They did a breath test and a lot, what was it? 50% of these asymptomatic people supposedly had SIBO, yeah, which again, to me is like red flag,
right?
Red flag. They feel fine. And they're the healthy, normal control group. And supposedly, I think it was like 50% of them had SIBO, which is that cannot be possibly true. Then they had them do a low fiber, higher simple carb and higher sugar diet for a week under the supervision of a dietitian. And within the week, pretty much everybody developed new GI symptoms. And a couple of people later were diagnosed with SIBO, like newly diagnosed SIBO because of the diet that they had done. And but importantly, when the people went back to eating their high fiber diet, all of the GI symptoms went away and they felt fine again.
It's wild.
Not surprising.
Right.
But yeah, it was a pretty cool study. I really hope that group repeats their work or like does a bigger scale version of that study. But you know, it, and we've talked about this because of this paper largely, SIBO is probably not the correct name for what people are suffering from. We need to call it SIMD, S-I-M-D, small intestinal microbial dysbiosis. Mm-hmm. That's the more appropriate name. The heck with the quantity, the heck with the idea of the overgrowth.
Yeah.
Y'all have dysbiosis in the small bowel and probably the colon as well. And that's what we need to be addressing. And the way you address dysbiosis is by increasing fiber and increasing nutrition and increasing diversity, not taking away those things.
Right.
So again, it's a snaps. Wonder why people are in such a deep hole and they don't know why. Did you just snap for me?
Yeah, I snapped for you.
Oh, that's my first snapping.
I feel like I've done it before. Maybe. I need to do it more.
Clearly, yeah. I need more of this in my life. There's a K-pop song, by the way, called Snapping, Chungha. I'm not going to try to sing it, in part because it's in Korea, in Korean, and partially because I would just embarrass myself. But go on YouTube, look up Chungha, Chungha, Snapping. And that's a K-pop song. And it's very catchy. I will text it to you later, my darling. Don't you worry.
Thank you.
I will enrich your life. Here's another little juicy tidbit from the second paper that I mentioned. They said, hence, focusing only on the antimicrobial effects without taking care to improve lifestyle factors, especially dietary patterns, may not yield satisfactory results and may even predispose to further GI dysfunction.
That's what
we're talking about.
Well, it's so interesting, too. I don't think I mentioned it when you were talking about it earlier, but I remember reading another study on, IBS in general, and they looked at, I don't think it was a huge study, but they had 42 people that they were looking at their dietary patterns of, and all of them, all 42, had the majority of their calories at dinner time. And like a lot were skipping breakfast, and most of them were not snacking. So it also is interesting, too, because what they found just redistributing the meals across the day seemed to help. Ooh, versus,
send
you know,
me that paper if you haven't already. That's a good one.
That was like a part. There was other things included in the dietary guidance, but like a big part, and they talked about it more in depth in the discussion part of the paper, was that they think if you spread things out more and not just get like your full, like, you know, 60% of your calories at dinner, you will probably digest and break things down better. And again, I'd imagine it's probably much better for your blood sugar to have more consistent eating style than that. But yeah, it is really interesting that like this IBS group was eating a ton. And maybe a lot of people do that. I don't know what the general population is, but yeah, it was just crazy to me that every single one of them got the majority of their calories from dinner. I think at least one person might get the majority of the calories somewhere else. But yeah, and some people eat rarely close to bedtime, like if you're eating a ton of food and then just kind of going to sleep. But, you know, it is really interesting because I think those little pieces can make a big difference. Again, equal to that of what maybe the low FODMAP would do, like just redistributing nutrition across the day could make a big difference and is much more simple and help root causal issues than, you know, just eliminating FODMAPs, if that makes sense.
Well, and I think that that's going to be good for motility. So you're not bombarding your system with all the food all at once. But it conjures up this idea of this metaphor I've shared before of imagining your digestive system as like an office worker in a cubicle.
Yeah.
If you can give that person routine and predictability and resources and guidance, they're going to do a really good job at their job, right? Like, okay, you clock in at 9 a.m. and your boss brings you 3 files to work on. And then you clock out at 12 noon for your lunch. You clock back in at 1 o'clock. Your boss brings you 3 more files to work on. You clock out at 5 p.m. You get to go home, disconnect, unplug, and then you come back and do it all over again. Same time, same kind of work demands. That's an employee that's going to do a really good job at their job because they know exactly what to expect and when to expect it. It's a manageable workload. They have the resources. They have the time. They have a regular kind of interval to the workday. Versus if you take that same cubicle worker employee and like, okay, one day they come in at 9, another day they get there at 7:30, another day they don't clock in until 9:30 and their boss is really pissed at them and they're all over the place. Some days they take lunch and some days they don't. And, you know, one day the boss comes in and gives you one piece of thing to work on and then you have to just play Tetris and look busy for the rest of the day. Another day you walk in and your boss gives you 36 files right. to work on and they all have to be done in like an hour immediately. This is the kind of behavior that we wouldn't want to do this to our employee, right? Because right. of course they're going to do a shitty job at their job and they're probably going to quit on us for that matter and leave because it's a toxic work environment. But then we're doing the same thing to our gut, where we're eating at different times, we're eating like oddly, you know, like weird amounts, and we're getting a whole shit ton of calories at one meal and like barely anything. We're skipping a meal for the other meals.
Right.
And it's just, it's like all over the place, all over the map. And we're either overwhelming or underwhelming that employee and ricochet. It just, of course, it's not doing a good job. Of right. course.
Yeah. Makes for sense. Sure. For sure.
You know, going back to the idea of dysbiosis briefly, though, because I don't want to neglect that because that's a really big deal. So the second paper that we mentioned here did a good job. They had a beautiful table even of the different articles that looked at the low FODMAP diet and like how it changes the microbiota. Right. But I'm going to make a judgment call on our audience. I could share the papers that found that low FODMAP reduces bifido and acromantia and faecalibacterium and decreases short chain fatty acid production. And like, we could talk about those. But honestly, I kind of don't think that people care all that much about the good bacteria. I think that that's more of like a you and me thing.
Right.
But what they might be very interested to know is they said, other studies showed that a reduction in FODMAP foods can significantly increase saccharolytic bacteroidetes, one that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, and bilophila. And yeah. they made a point of saying bilophila, a hydrogen sulfide producing species, may likely be involved in the pathogenesis of hydrogen sulfide SIBO. Furthermore, a study conducted by Bennett et al. Revealed that 42% of IBS patients scored higher on the dysbiosis index after 4 weeks. Amy, when's the last time you got a client who was only on low FODMAP for 4 weeks?
Oh my God, never.
42% of IBS patients scored higher on the dysbiosis index score after 4 weeks on a low FODMAP diet, while a traditional diet decreased the dysbiosis score in 33% of IBS patients.
Wow.
So that might be more of what people actually care about. And they actually went as far as to quote a paper that called the low FODMAP diet anti-prebiotic.
Oof, yeah.
Because you're taking away prebiotics and right. you're robbing the microbiome of their food. So, you know, even if you don't give a crap really about bifido or lactobacillus or faecalibacterium or any of these good guys, you should very much care about an increased level of bilophila and some of these nasty bad guys, because that's exactly what you're trying to treat.
Yeah.
You're doing the diet trying to reduce the number of bad guys. And that's the complete total opposite of what you're probably doing.
Right.
Now, again, maybe we will get some research eventually that shows that, like, Klebsiella specifically loves FODMAPs. And maybe, and I know there's one study in particular, it was looking more at histamine levels, but there was at least one paper that seemed to suggest that the low FODMAP diet reduced Klebsiella. But it was like one sample. It was one person, I think, if I remember right. But my point is, y'all are on this witch hunt to yeah. kill and starve the bad guys. But we have actual scientific evidence telling us that reducing prebiotics in the diet significantly, their words, not mine, significantly increases several bad guys.
Yeah.
And you wonder why you're stuck.
Right.
Now, Amy, can I, coming off of that rant, can I, permission to horrify you?
Sure.
Okay. See, it's a good thing that we record this in the middle of the day, so you have time to process the trauma before going to bed, because I didn't send you this paper. So I know we talked about the two. Have you read the paper that looked at a case series of using the carnivore diet to treat SIBO?
Oh, God, no. I just can only imagine. I've had a few clients who've done carnivore, and let me tell you, some of the wildest stool studies I've seen.
Oh, you talk about a deep hole.
Yeah.
We had a person ask about FODMAP freedom this time, interestingly. So when the nutritionist who works for me, when she was doing discovery calls, she told me about this lady, and she said, yeah, the lady said she does the carnivore diet and she's not willing to change. She is not going to change that. She's not going to reintroduce plants. And she wants to know if FODMAP freedom is going to be right for her. And I'm like, well, no. The name suggests that I want you to be free to eat the FODMAPs. And that would like probably be a big part of what I do here. But what was interesting about this lady, she said, the carnivore diet was, and I believe I'm quoting here, tremendously healing for me. I think those were her words. The carnivore diet was tremendously healing, and she's not willing to change it. Dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot. Oh, but I'm having diarrhea and bloating every single day, and I feel like crap, and I have a lot that I need to work on. I'm like, maybe that diet's not as healing as you think it is.
Yeah.
Just a thought. Anyway, we ended up directing her elsewhere because I do not think that FODMAP freedom is a good fit for her. But let's noodle on this for just a quick minute. So I'll send you the paper. First of all, this was hard to find. I did not find this on a PubMed search because it's not indexed on PubMed. And reading it, I don't mean to be a jerk, but you read enough research papers and you get a sense for like the caliber of the writing that goes into an actual, like, you know, if you read something that was in like Nature or Lancet, or Cell, you get a kind of feel for like the quality of writing that goes into this. This paper did not have that caliber of writing. I can see, but this paper is not indexed on PubMed at all, which is which tells me it's low quality. And when you go and look at it, the website that I found it on actually said like, oh, BTW, this might not have been peer reviewed. And that does not surprise me based on the caliber of the studies. But nonetheless, bitchy moment aside, they did try to do a study using the carnivore diet for SIBO. So we're gonna look at this and give it a chance. The title is A Zero Carbohydrate Carnivore Diet Can Normalize Hydrogen Positive Small Intestinal Bacterial Overgrowth Lactulose Breath Tests, a Case Report. And this was published in January of 2021. Right out the gate, can you tell me the first problem? I feel like I'm quizzing you.
I don't know. I wasn't. I think I blacked out for a second.
That's okay. So they were using lactulose breath testing.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
First.
Yeah, for sure.
First, huge major red flag. We didn't even get past the title, and we're already seeing a big red flag. So most likely, at least, you know, four or five of these people probably don't have SIBO, because we know that there's a horrendously high rate of false positives with the lactulose breath test. So this is making me weep already, because they're using a totally inaccurate test, and that they're doing like the most severe restrictive diet on planet Earth based off of very low quality evidence to support this diagnosis. So that's that. I'm like, oh God.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a lot I could pick apart in this study, but what I wanted to highlight for you, and this is what'll give you nightmares. So first of all, they said that the elemental diet, is, as well as low FODMAP, is continuously being used with a high success rate in remission. We don't have evidence to support that.
Right.
There's not a crumb of evidence to support that. You're just, again, and I know that clinical, like clinical experience is a level of evidence, but like you can't really claim that in a research paper. But here's what I want to highlight. They concluded it was wonderful, it was miraculous, it was great. But they said, according to our observations, it also resulted in better satisfaction after meals, decreased cravings for sweets, and generated weight loss in patients where it is needed. And I made a note to myself, and I said, how did they deem needed weight loss? And I looked at the paper, and I was fishing for, okay, did they give like a weight or a BMI pre and post? Is there any indication if these patients actually were overweight or not?
Right.
Nope. Not, no. There's no indication of whether or not they were actually overweight to begin with. But here's what, to flesh that out more. And again, this was a 6-patient cohort that they followed. And they did the carnivore diet for either 4 or 6 weeks for 5 of them. And then one person, I think, only did it for 2 weeks. 2 patients experienced what they called rapid weight loss. Oh,
God.
Red flag. 3 patients lost 2 kilograms over the course of a month. So what would that be? Like 4.4 pounds? I mean, I guess that's not the worst, but 1 person lost 10 kilograms.
Oh, my God.
22 pounds in a month, Amy.
It's insane. It's
insane. Way too much. Not good. 1 person experienced body aches during the first week. 1 had diarrhea and low energy in the first 2 weeks. Again, clearly, like, this is not agreeing with them. 1 had adjustment problems with diarrhea and rapid weight loss in the first week. This was the person who lost 10 kilograms, by the way. But supposedly, she enjoyed the diet and continued with a low-carbohydrate, low-fiber diet after the treatment was done.
Wow.
Fan-freaking-tastic. So
that's crazy.
This poor person felt like crap doing it. And was probably instructed to push through and keep doing it because you're starving the SIBO. Hooray for you. Lost a crap load of weight. And now she's probably brainwashed or convinced or terrified that carbs are the enemy, fiber is the enemy. And now she's just going to keep doing the carnivore diet for the rest of her days, apparently. Because, you know, it went so well. That's why she's going to continue doing it. Because it agreed with her so beautifully and so swimmingly that you might as well continue it, right?
Sounds about right.
But I was like, man, oh man, they had some good, there was a good effort. So again, they tested everybody pre and post. So that was good. The infamous D-lactic acidosis study, one of my biggest beefs with that study when it came out was that they didn't retest at the end of the study to see if placebo was gone. They didn't make an attempt at that. So at least these people tested pre and post. And because it was a functional medicine place, they made a point to, like, they did NutriEvals and GI effects stool test, and they did a couple of other tests to try to assess the person more in depth. So I give them some credit where credit is due. But again, I do not think that this is the level of evidence we need to support recommending the carnivore diet to people, especially understanding that fiber is critical for microbiome health. I don't care if the carnivore people come with axes after me. I will stand on this soapbox until proven otherwise. But up until this point, I am convinced that fiber is critical for microbiome health. And you take that away, and I think it's going to bite you in the ass eventually. So I just, I personally cannot recommend the carnivore diet in any way, shape, or form for gut healing.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I do have to wrap up here.
Okay. Well, that works out perfectly because I probably should too. But let's give the good people at home an executive summary. Please nourish yourself first and foremost. Don't neglect the microbes because they very much need fiber and nutrients and colors and polyphenols and things to keep them happy and healthy. And they will pay you back for that favor. SIBO diets have zero evidence. There's no such thing as a SIBO diet to the best of our knowledge right now. Maybe we will get better research on that moving forward. Maybe we won't. But as it stands right now, there's zero evidence for the use of these diets. And there is very, very good evidence that these diets are going to dig you into a much deeper hole than you started with. Do you think that's a pretty good executive summary?
I think it's perfect.
And y'all have SIBD, not SIBO anyway. Stop treating the SIBO. Start treating small intestinal microbial dysbiosis, and you'll be better off for it.
Love it.
All right. Shall we snap our way out?